Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code SPOILER2.
Welcome to Slate's Spoiler Special Podcast. I'm David Haglund, and I'm joined not by Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic, but by June Thomas, a culture critic for Slate. Hello, June.
Hey, David.
This is a very special spoiler special because we're not discussing a movie. We're going to be discussing all 13 episodes of Season 1 of House of Cards, which became available on Netflix on Friday. June and I both managed to watch all 13 by Saturday night.
Right. And, David, I was... You know, that's the kind of thing I do every weekend. But I was very surprised that you did it because you're a kind of guy who I imagine like reading books and going to the movies and actually leaving the house and the couch.
I should have been reading some books, but it was cold out.
It was.
My girlfriend and I had no plans and we just clicked next again and again and again.
Awesome.
So definitely one of the things we want to talk about is why we kept clicking next. But maybe first we should get into some of the plot of
right.
this show.
Right. So I'll kick off. So this is an American version of a British show, a BBC show from 1990. House of Cards, of course, makes a little more sense in reference to the House of Commons. But I was impressed by how much Bo Willimon, the author, differentiated it and made it a believably American show. But it tells the story of Frank Underwood, who is the chief whip in the House.
The majority whip, yeah.
Yeah, majority whip. And he has, thank you, he has, you know, he's a...
Well, he's a Democrat. And
right.
He represents some southern district.
So, in South Carolina, because they went to Charleston.
Thought, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Although that was to go to the... Anyway. So he's the great manipulator in Congress. He's been in Congress for many terms. He's a powerful man. He has a beautiful and rather cold wife, played... really very well by Robin Wright. I was surprised by how good she was.
She's terrific.
Yeah.
We don't see her enough, I don't
know.
No,
think. And I know I just want to have her on screen every week. And she also is a bit of a DC macker. She runs a nonprofit. And together they have a kind of Macbeth, Lady Macbeth relationship. At the beginning, he's disappointed, to say the least, because he had been promised the Secretary of State job. But the new president, who he helped elect, passes him over, reneges on the promise, and because he needs him in Congress.
Right. And I think most of that people would grab from the trailer.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about watching so much so quickly is how the other characters come to the fore. If you've only seen the trailer, you might suspect that, oh, it's all about Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright and Kate Mara, who plays this reporter for the Washington Herald,
right.
which I gather we're supposed to think of as the Washington Post.
I believe so.
She's this young Metro reporter who's a real go-getter and manages to get offered the job of White House correspondent after she's fed a bunch of stories by Frank Underwood, the
right.
Kevin Spacey character, which he does on the condition that she reports exactly what he wants her to do, no questions asked, and she agrees because mm-hmm. she, like him, is completely Machiavellian, just wants to get ahead.
Right.
But then, within a few episodes, Corey Stoll, as this Pennsylvania congressman, mm-hmm. really comes to the fore as well. And
yep.
I think he's the best thing about the series.
I agree. I loved him. He was very likable. You know, his struggle was real, which I thought was a great – you know, it wasn't just that his character, Peter Russo, who was really just a – you know, he was just a puppet that Frank Underwood was manipulating, and it could have been just exactly that level of, oh, this is just some guy whose strings he's pulling. But he became a very likable, very real character, very vulnerable, that I was rooting for and was very interested in, and really, you know, nothing in the show is particularly realistic. And
right.
so it's not, you know, I don't want to even start those conversations because yeah, it's just not. But it was about kind of falling for the characters or learning to hate the characters. Although, actually, even though some of these people were really reprehensible, I didn't actually hate anyone, really.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there are some somewhat odd moments that where the show goes out of its way to humanize even the Kevin Spacey character.
Right.
So, for instance, we get a whole episode where he goes back to what they call the Sentinel, which mm-hmm. I assume is the Citadel.
I would think so.
It's a military school back in South Carolina, and they're naming a library after him, and so he's there for the ceremony. And he's brought these or he's invited these three, I think, three
yes.
buddies
yes.
With whom he used to sing a cappella
right.
and does again.
Yes.
And with whom, as we gradually realize, with one of whom he had some kind of gay affair, some
right.
kind of romance
right.
when they were high school kids.
Yeah. And it seems to be a very positive relationship. And they also give the sense that he's kind of pausing for a moment, like, should I rekindle this? Even though they now both are married, the other guy has kids. And the other guy says, I was just glad to be able to make you happy or to please you or something like that, which is sounds weird, but at the same time is very believable and does feel convincing and real. And I don't really know why that's necessary for Frank's character, but
right.
I bought it, let's just say.
Yeah, I did too. And I think it's fair to say that he's presented as a heterosexual man
yep.
who had this fling
yep.
with another man when he was young. But he's not closeted.
Right.
This isn't
right.
some
right.
you know, key to his psychology or anything like that.
And I absolutely agree. However, there was for both Frank and Claire. Claire, I don't know if I said that was his wife's name earlier. For both Frank and Claire, you have a feeling that the two of them are a unit. They're very close. They share everything, including cigarettes, which is a bit of a motif that runs through the show. You know, that's where they, you know, really get real, I guess.
Yeah, they sit by the window and
yeah.
smoke together.
Yeah, but it doesn't. But they also, you know, they have jealousies of each other's relationships. But you feel like these relationships, in fact, probably all of their relationships, are kind of mercenary and transactional. That you don't know that they actually have feelings, even for each other.
Right. In fact, one of the things that grabbed me relatively early on and which the show disappointed me on somewhat later was that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That it's so
yep.
open. You learn at some point early on that he knows that she's had an affair and doesn't seem particularly concerned about whether she starts it again just so long as he knows.
Right.
And when a few episodes in, his relationship with Kate Mara, the sexy blogger,
right.
becomes carnal, he tells her that too. And
yeah.
and she's completely fine with it as long as she's someone he can control.
Right.
So
right.
that hints at this incredibly you know, sinister relationship that
mm-hmm.
the two have that's
mm-hmm.
all about ambition, that has nothing
mm-hmm.
to do with love. I think I expected that to go a little bit further than it did.
I mean, that was I kept hitting next. So clearly my problems that I had were apparently minor, but that was my biggest frustration with the whole show, that even though it was good enough to keep me going, I felt like they wasted endless opportunities. I mean, it was 13 hours of material, and that was really enough time to flesh out a lot of things, whether they're plots and machinations or characters, and especially on the character level, but also in a certain way in the plot. They just kind of things petered out.
They did. And I'm curious whether, for instance, late in the season, to reveal a fairly big spoiler, Claire stabs him in the back, really. There's a deal. There's a bill. It's called the Watershed Bill that Frank really wants to get passed. And Peter Russo, the Corey Stoll congressman, also really wants to get passed. But for slightly complicated reasons having to do with a nonprofit that she
mm-hmm.
runs,
mm-hmm.
She doesn't persuade these two on-the-fence congressmen that Frank expects her to persuade to vote for it.
And
the bill fails.
Right. Exactly. And I'd never really understood her motivations regarding her own nonprofit. I don't know that that was a red herring or just a kind of something that didn't work. Because, again, at the beginning, in what I think it seems like we both agree, the beginning is just kind of a lot of throat clearing that,
yeah.
you know, it just gets a lot better after the first couple of episodes. But she, maybe even in the first episode, she just fires half the people on the staff. And so in a way, okay, it establishes she's kind of a bitch and she's kind of uncaring. But you never really know why she, you know, so partly she wants to make it an international organization, maybe because she thinks Frank's still going to be Secretary of State. But
Yeah, it's not very well explained. It's not very well explained. And her ambitions are never as well spelled out as they should be. Right. And also this brings up a kind of larger issue with the show. And it's funny how much criticism that we're lobbying at it, given that I think we both really enjoyed it, is that there's really not a trace of idealism in the show. And I think that's fine. I think it still works.
Yeah.
But I actually think that would have gone a long way. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that we both liked the Peter Russo character so much, who, even though he's not idealistic, at least is likable.
Right.
As horrible as he is, you do root for him.
Right. Because, yes, although he has no ideology and he still cares about something. He cares about the people in his district. You know, as a friend of mine, a TV critic in Philadelphia, said, you know, we also live in a universe where the Philadelphia Navy Yard is still open, which it hasn't been for many years. But, you know, in some ways, he knows that the people who elected him are going to be mad. But he also doesn't want them to lose their job. He's not just concerned about his own job. He's concerned about these people. He feels he has a connection with people. You kind of see that he's had a horrible time. His mother's a bitch. You like him. And even though, again, it's not that he has ideology. It's not because he believes in principles. He cares about people, and it seems to be the only person with genuine emotions almost.
Yeah, he's given a recognizable political backstory as well because he's the kid up from the streets.
Right.
And that's his whole persona. Early on, we see he has this friend who still is involved with the shipyard who comes to see him and is presented in fairly stereotypical way as, the working class guy who doesn't shave that regularly or whatever. I'm not sure why they had to go that far. But that's where he comes from.
Yeah.
And so I think you're given a sense, this is how he's presented himself to his constituency. Mm-hmm. This is his persona as a politician. Weirdly, Frank Underwood doesn't quite have that. I mean, I mentioned on the Culture Gabfest this week that as a white male Southern Democrat, he's a little bit of an anomaly.
Yes.
He also has a big painting of Teddy Roosevelt in his office. And even though Teddy Roosevelt is sort of a bipartisan hero now, he is a Republican.
Right.
And it's not clear who his political heroes would be.
Yep.
He's really all about power.
Exactly. And you see in one episode, he goes back to his home district, not for no positive reason. It's just because he's got a problem there. There's, this weird, hard to explain and really not worth explaining issue that just might cause him to have trouble getting reelected, which you think, really, the Senate majority, whatever. The House majority leader would have a problem with that. But he has to go back and you think, this guy, it's just about power. There's no other connection.
Right. Although that is, I think, also what drives the show. Because to get in again to the spoilers, ultimately, he's refused the Secretary of State position. He has a moment of thought or a few moments of thought plotting out his great plan. And then he puts it into practice. And as the episodes go on, and especially as you near the end, you're at least made to believe, and we can discuss whether this persuasive or not, that all the things he's done from that moment until the end of the season were a way of setting himself up for the vice presidency.
Right.
Which emerges later on. And the way that happens is that Peter Russo is this congressman from Pennsylvania that we've been talking about. Spacey, Frank Underwood, pushes him to run for governor. So the governorship is open because the current vice president, who's just been elected, was the governor.
Right.
So there's going to be a special election. He pushes for Russo to run, knowing, I think we're led to believe, knowing that he could crush him when the moment came.
And that he plans indeed to crush him. That Frank has an aide who we'd never really understand why that aide would be so loyal, why he would do something which, the aide is himself, I believe, still a recovering alcoholic, and he gets Russo into the program, but then completely sabotages. I mean, you could say he puts him to the test. Maybe he would pass the test, but the chances, it seems that no one considers for a minute that he might pass the test and turn down the drugs and booze and whore who's offered to him.
Right. Yeah, in some ways that character, I know the character's name is Doug Stamper. I can't recall the actor's name, but he is possibly the most sinister character. I mean, even more than Underwood and his wife. One, because he doesn't have the obvious public power that those two have. He just works for Frank, and he does so ruthlessly. The way that the whole Russo plot starts is that Russo is arrested for solicitation and maybe also drunk driving.
Yes.
And Frank and Doug manage to clear that arrest by calling in a favor with the police commissioner who's about to run for Congress, I believe, or mayor?
Maybe mayor of D.C.
Yeah. So they clear that arrest and then let Russo know that they're the ones who did that, and now he owes them big time.
And they, you know, the idea is that they're doing this for every member of the House. Like, they just need information. They just need to have something. They need to be holding things over every single congressman.
Right. And actually, one of the things that I was confused about at the end and was trying to recall is when Frank decides that he has seen his path to power, because in theory, that should only happen after he's busted Russo, because Russo's connection to Pennsylvania is crucial.
Right.
But in my memory, I think he decides before that, oh, I've got it. Well, I have figured it out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess because he has to get the vice president to both be so disenchanted with the position that he's currently in, so mad at the president, so feeling so useless. And then Frank needs to create a situation where with only weeks or even days before the gubernatorial election, the vice president can step down and go into that position, which, first of all, you know, you can – like, we're going to have a write-in vote? What, is he on the ballot? It kind of makes no sense. But so he you know, I guess either way, if Russo didn't fail, but no, that wouldn't work. He had to.
Yeah,
Russo
he had to fail. And
he had to get the vice president.
Yeah, which made me wonder to what extent that idea that is very strongly hinted at the end really holds water.
Right.
Because also, you know, there are a bunch of machinations early on, the relevance of which later seem unclear.
Exactly.
So, for instance, the first thing he does is he sabotages the nomination for Secretary of State, who has essentially taken his place. This guy, Michael Kern, I think is his name.
Yes, yes. Who is a douche.
Yes.
Of the first order.
Well, who's not on the show, really?
Exactly.
But he sabotages him with this complicated plot that involves Peter Russo turning in a favor for him, digging up this old editorial that ran in a student newspaper.
Right. Williams College, your student newspaper has never caused so much trouble.
I know. And actually, I really enjoyed all of that. I really liked the way that was done. You see Kern going on the news shows and totally botching the interviews.
Yeah.
And I bought all that. In fact, I think in general, the clips of news shows that we see are better done here than they are on, you know, in the usual sort of there's so many Hollywood movies that have done that.
Right.
And all of this sets up the nomination of this woman, Kathleen Durant. Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
How does that help him get to the vice presidency? It wasn't clear.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he wanted to be Secretary of State and he put her in just because he was someone. Yeah, it didn't. I'm struggling because it never made sense. And then, you know, you do have this feeling that this is a guy who just gets stuff over people. And so now she owed him. But then when he came to ask for something again for Claire's nonprofit, she wasn't able to come through. And there didn't seem to be anything that they could do to her. You know, whereas usually you think the whole point of this man is to gain evidence against people and to be, you know, cruel and to mete out justice. And in this case, he was kind of dissed and he didn't seem to do anything about it that I can recall, right? He just kind of, well, thanks for nothing.
Yeah. And in fact, I think part of the reason this show works as an addictive series, but which maybe in hindsight feels underwhelming in certain respects, is that all of these plot points, they grab you as they're happening.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's really interesting to see them unravel that guy's nomination.
Yep.
There's this education bill.
Yep. There's a terrible thing with teachers. That's just awful.
Terrible in the sense that you weren't persuaded by it or you thought it was ridiculous?
All of it. Yeah.
Okay. Everything. I mean, it's very far-fetched because the entire nation of teachers, I guess, goes on strike.
Yeah.
So no kids are in school.
Right.
And then a kid is shot in a drive-by. He would have been in school.
Right.
So this becomes this key political weapon
right.
for Frank. But I have to say, I really liked the scene between him and the union boss, because the way that plot is resolved is that he goads the union boss in a private
right.
meeting
right.
to punch him in the face.
Right.
And because part of their debate up to this point has been about the supposedly violent tactics
right.
of the union, which, of course, were all engineered by Frank.
Right.
This is devastating
yeah.
for the union boss. This would not only ruin his position in this debate, but it would probably ruin his career.
Right.
He could file criminal charges. So Frank says, all right, look, I'm not going to press charges. This is over. I won.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt from the control room, David, but I'm just going to take a moment to shout out our sponsor. This episode of the Spoiler Special is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project, Shutterstock sources video clips from all around the world and puts them at your fingertips. And many of the contributions to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy. Shutterstock has sophisticated tools so you can search out and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor, and more. And Shutterstock is the complete offering. They have flexible pricing, so you can download clips in HD, or you can save with standard definition or web formats. As a video producer myself, I find Shutterstock a great resource for finding and downloading any kind of stock video I could need for a creative project. So you can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to a clip box. Once you decide to purchase, offer the special code SPOILER2, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use the offer code SPOILER2. We thank Shutterstock for their support. All right, David and June, back to you.
I mean, I agree with what you just said about the way the plot works. It's good enough, and then you kind of forget about it. And that actually became the one time that it became a problem for me, because there aren't any previously ons in this. You know, you just keep pressing next, I guess, was when toward the end, I felt that the last couple of hours were the weakest bit. It just like it really didn't come together. But they suddenly bring up the guy who had actually written the editorial, and they just mentioned his name, and they didn't really give any context, which I usually applaud that approach to storytelling where you don't, you know, hold the audience's hand too much. But in this case, I just couldn't remember whose name is. Who's this, whatever it was, Peter Kopernik or whatever. Like, who is that? And I don't think it was unreasonable of me not to remember, you know, to have kind of semi-forgotten because, you know, 11 or 12 hours had passed or whatever it was. It was significant amount of time enough that even though I did indeed, you know, marathon the show, the plot, the details of the machinations had kind of fallen away.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What's funny is that those machinations, it's just so fun to watch somebody doing that sort of thing, manipulating people in this way that, I mean, I'm totally game for season two.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have started it on Sunday
exactly.
if it had been available.
Exactly.
And I do think the show does a good job of setting up the next season while also providing something like closure for the first season.
Yes.
Because when it's over, you know that he is going to be the nominee for vice president.
Right. Right.
But you don't know if he's going to actually succeed in getting that position.
Yep.
And there are some things hanging over his head, and we don't know what exactly his relationship is with Kate Mara's character at that point, the reporter. That has frayed in various ways.
Yep.
It becomes sexual. Then they stop that. Then they start it again. It's not clear whether they can have the same professional relationship.
And in a way, she also learns, you know, during the show, there's this very conflict. She has a conflicted relationship with a senior woman reporter. And as the show kind of progresses, her Zoe Barnes, that's the Kate Mara character's, allegiance to Frank kind of fades, and her relationship with the other woman kind of blossoms, and the other reporter kind of gets her into the real chase, you know,
right.
really being a reporter, not just being fed lines by a highly placed source. And you know, really, it's all very unrealistic. But I enjoyed that kind of move, that shift from the manipulator to the, yeah, she's actually doing her job. And you see, gosh, she really could be good at her job.
Right. Especially assuming that we have no more conversations about how the news media is doomed by the internet because
exactly.
those fell with such a thud.
Although, you know, I have to say that there was a, you know, I, you know, I was looking at Twitter while I was watching, and there were people saying, can you believe that is the most ridiculous, unrealistic, you know, that essentially Zoe Barnes turns down the chance of becoming the Washington Herald's White House reporter, and she declines the offer, partly because Frank tells her not to, essentially. But, you know, it actually, to me, that does seem like a really good career move. And yeah, she essentially goes to Politico, although, you know, they have the sense to say, you remember what Politico was 2 years ago? Well, Slugline is that now. And it's the weirdest office. It's like it's just such a horrible office. But you think, well, actually, yeah, why would she want to be a White House correspondent and just sit in briefings and, you know.
Right, and be fed talking points. Yeah. I'm with you. I actually think that part of her story makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
And it also makes sense when this older female reporter then also leaves the Herald and joins her.
Yeah.
And when season one closes, they're now on the trail of Frank. They have basically figured it out.
Yes.
Or they're at least very close to figuring out all of the things that he has done to put himself in this position, and it's hinted that maybe in season two that'll be part of what happens.
Right.
The other big thing that happens near the end, and this makes me less hopeful about season two, but maybe they'll somehow replace him, is that Peter Russo dies in what is easily the gravest of Frank Underwood's many sins.
Right.
After Russo has this meltdown. You know, he's set up by Doug Stamper with a prostitute who he had already slept with once before. It's the same one he was arrested with.
Although he doesn't remember.
Yeah, he doesn't remember her, but she remembers him. And Stamper, who has, you know, since that arrest, gone and found her and put her up in someone's house.
And sincerely
and
helped
her.
Yeah. Right.
He then sets her up to sabotage Russo, to get him drinking again, to have sex with him. And then he has a radio interview the very next morning that is crucial, and he's drunk.
Right.
And he handles it horribly. He swears on the air, and it's the end of his career, and he's drinking again, and he's depressed. But then Frank manages to lock him into his garage under his apartment, leave the car running, make it look like a suicide.
Right. And in the British version, which this Netflix version, you know, really did shift away from, but that's kind of the start of a next level of escalation for Francis Urquhart in the British version, that he kind of becomes not a homicidal maniac exactly, but, you know, once he pops his cherry,
he gets worse and worse.
He kills again.
See, I hope that the show doesn't go down that road, because,
okay,
another bit of praise for the show is that while Frank is terrible, and while various aspects of the show, as we've already discussed, are not particularly plausible, he's not killing people left and right.
Yeah.
He's not even responsible for other people killing people, which is one of the things that Hollywood thrillers do all the time, which drives me crazy.
Yes.
So, for instance, in a movie that I thought was a bit overpraised, Michael Clayton, there's all this killing going on. It's actually, you know, not that easy to kill high-profile people.
Yep.
And not attract any attention.
Well, and you know, I have to say that what Frank does and what Francis Urquhart did in the British, in a way, they are just making sure that somebody who kind of wants to kill himself succeeds.
Right.
You know, their behavior is suicidal in the long term, and the guy just kind of puts them out of the, you know.
Right.
In the British one, they actually says it was a mercy killing. I don't know if there was any, I don't believe there was any specific verbiage like that in the US version. But you have a feeling that he's just, you know, he's just avoiding any more humiliation for for the poor man. One thing I did want to mention that I just kind of saw on Twitter before we started to come in here and talk about this, but Alyssa Rosenberg had a tweet today where she said that one of the things that she liked least about the show was that Frank was essentially the only smart person in DC. You know, he was the great man of machinations. No one else was capable of any kind of, you know, no one was at his level. He and Doug, who was just working in his service, were the only people who knew how to work the system. Everyone else was just a bunch of dupes. And that was too bad.
I think he needs a nemesis of some kind.
Yeah.
I mean, Linda Vasquez, who's the president's chief of staff, when she first appears, you think, oh, maybe she's on to Frank and she's that clever, but actually she's a total dupe as well.
She is.
The president is kind of amusingly presented as really dopey.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's not a caricature, but he just does not seem clued in.
Right.
And you're right. I don't think the only person who even comes to mind is this guy Remy Danton, who is a lobbyist, I believe.
Yeah, now he is, yes.
Yeah, who used to be Frank's press secretary. Yep. And it sort of makes sense that someone who worked for Frank would now become this operator.
Although that was why I had hopes for Linda Vasquez, because she also apparently had worked for Frank, and he'd, you know, he'd gotten her into that – he'd machinated her right into that position. But then she – she was blamed. And
well, and they end up working hand in hand, even though she doesn't really know what's going on.
Right.
I would like to see them turn her character into some kind of antagonist in season two, because I think she at least still has the potential to seem that savvy.
And
I do think they need to replace the Peter Russo character. They need to somehow – and they should not do so with Claire Underwood's paramour.
No.
This New York artist who just is so uninteresting. And that, I mean, was one of the, in hindsight, big disappointments of season one, is that they spend a lot of time with Claire and this guy.
Yeah.
And those scenes are dull.
No. I mean, it's like the only – I loved Robin Wright. I kind of loved Claire's character, but in the end, all that they did was kind of sketch in a few things. Oh, she's going through changes. Maybe it's the change. Maybe she's questioning, you know, some of her allegiances, some of the choices that she's made. But in the end, all you can say is, well, maybe.
Right.
And so one of the things that she maybes is she, you know, rekindles an old affair. But it goes nowhere. And then and I would say that one of the very worst scenes in the whole thing was, so he's a New York artist, and of course he lives in a beautiful loft, and he has a party, and it's just like the most cliched artist party with, you know, some skinny chick, you know, gets asked Claire to dance, and they're kind of, you know, you think, oh my God, what is going on here?
I turned to my girlfriend and said, oh, apparently they went to the 1960s. Because it was like those scenes in Mad Men with like the beatnik parties. Like, where is this?
Exactly.
It's totally implausible. And worse, it kind of makes her character more conventional, weirdly.
Yes.
Because the relationship she has with Frank is so strange
and
compellingly so. And you think, oh, who is this woman that she has this totally open but totally sinister marriage and has her own ambitions? But then she starts to think, maybe I wish I had a baby.
Yes.
Maybe I really should have gone for true love with this artist.
Yes. And really all she needs to do is focus on her origami.
Right. There was another – that whole detail with the homeless man outside. I mean
– Or let's also talk about Frank's great connection, which is with Frank – or what is the name of the –
Freddy,
the barbecue.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what we're going to call that particular relationship, because it's – is it meant to humanize Frank? Because it kind of doesn't for me. It is so creepy and condescending and like – tinny-eared. Everything about it was,
and I wish the show had shown some distance from that condescension, by giving Freddie, who's played by Reg E. Cathy, who I love, and people might recognize from The Wire,
right? Exactly.
He's fantastic, but he's never given a moment on his own to show any distance from Frank.
Right, right.
So he's just Frank's lackey, and Frank clearly pays him well. He shows up, he has a cup, you know, has a half rack of ribs or whatever, and then gives him $100.
Right.
So we can see why he would do it.
Right.
But he's never shown kind of being repelled at all.
No, exactly.
Or just having
I just want to see him give Frank the finger, you know, just when Frank's back is turned, and he doesn't. He's thinking, okay.
Yeah. So – and late in the season, Remy shows up at that – it's, you know, at Freddy's.
Right.
I would like to see more of Reg Cathy and maybe a little bit more of Remy.
Right.
And maybe there's something there.
Yes,
or,
exactly.
You know, I mean
– exactly.
Those characters need to be developed a little bit more.
Agreed.
So I also thought we should talk a little bit about how we experience the show. What we think of this whole format.
Right.
I mean, both of us just burned through it. I was happy to do so. I realize I think I prefer watching shows this way. I don't have cable. And I find it frustrating watching a show on a Monday or whatever.
Usually
it's a Sunday. So watch a show on a Sunday and then wait a week to see the next one.
Yeah. I mean, I generally watch TV in the classic way because I like to watch shows when they're new. I did think that one of – you know, Netflix did it this way because this is Netflix's differentiator. You know, Netflix lets you watch things all at once. Thank you, Netflix. But to me, it's the easiest kind of it's the easiest show to get people to watch, especially to drop it on a Friday when there's really, we know there's nothing on Friday or Saturday. It was winter, at least, you know, and so on the East Coast, you know, there's less motivation than ever to go out. There aren't many good new movies opening. It was, you know, very good circumstances because really all it has to do is it good enough to say next?
Right.
To hit next. And if it is, you know, I didn't intend to watch the whole thing. I often spend an entire weekend sitting in front of the television watching different shows, but this was not how I had planned to spend the weekend. And so clearly it was good enough to keep me hitting next. But to me, it's much, much harder to, you know, make a show that will, every Monday I'm going to come and see that. Maybe there'll be preemption one week for the State of the Union, or maybe I'm going to have to pay attention to my TiVo programming because maybe this week there's another show that's conflicting at 9 p.m. You know, just all of that, it's such a higher level of difficulty. It's a
right.
much higher degree of difficulty to make a convent, to for someone to buy in to a conventional show and watch every episode. And so to me, it's, you know, they spent a lot of money on this. I thank them for that. But I don't know that they should get that much praise for keeping people hitting next.
Right. I think you're right that that in itself is not a testament to the show's greatness.
Yeah.
It's maybe a testament to the show's quality. There's some baseline level that you think, I want to watch more.
Yes. Yes.
But actually planning your schedule around and, you know, the next one and waiting a week is actually harder in a way.
Yeah.
I also think, I'm curious whether you feel like you sacrificed a certain amount when it comes to, say, social media in particular, being on Twitter, reading recaps and all of that stuff. I didn't miss it.
I didn't miss it. And it, you know, it's funny. I know that you published on Browbeat a really funny piece on Friday by Sam Adams about the rules for House of Cards spoilers. And because that, you know, typically I don't, I mean, I'm concerned about spoilers in a professional way. You know, when I do the Downton Abbey TV Club, I'm very careful not to put spoilers in headlines, for example. But if I'm, you know, June Schmo on social media and I'm watching a show, I'll go ahead and tweet about it unless it's something sensitive. I was a little circumspect because I was aware that, you know, what's the timetable on this one? What are the rules? It was less clear. But I certainly didn't miss. And, you know, I can read it now. It's, you know, it's all still fresh. It's not like coming back, you know, it's not like I'm watching. I watched Breaking Bad first three or four seasons altogether. I might, you know, I could have gone back and caught up on maybe not the tweets, but, you know, the recaps and stuff. And but I didn't, you know.
Yeah. When I like a show enough, I've gone back. Certainly with The Wire, I went back and read some coverage of the first few seasons. First few seasons. I should say for myself, though I am on Twitter and on all the time, I don't tweet while I'm watching a TV show. I'm not that interested.
You're
in
not as much
people's
of a narcissist as I am.
I don't know if I'd say that.
I would say that.
But so I didn't miss it either. And I think that, you know, longer reviews and recaps that take in the whole season will start to appear over the next week or so. Yep. And I'll keep an eye out for them and I will read them. I'm curious to see what people make of it.
It's funny, though. I was a little kind of – I had some fatigue in the end about all of the stories about Netflix's business model because there were an awful lot of them. But I kind of read a bunch of them, too. And I almost think that it is the more interesting aspect of, you know – the business story is more interesting than the story, even though, again, you know, like it was fine. I enjoyed it with some significant reservations, but it's just a, you know, a pleasant enough show. It's nothing special. There were some very, very, very good acting performances, but, you know, it's
it didn't
it's
change
okay.
the way I think about Washington.
No, exactly. No.
And whereas it may have changed the way I think about TV. So I think you're right that the business side is more interesting. And in some ways, I mean, the real test of this is going to be Arrested Development in May because there's so much built up interest in that.
And that is more unconventional, too. You know, this is a series. You didn't have to watch it all in one sitting. Some of us did. But it was a show that kind of built from one episode to the next. Arrested Development apparently is going to be something, you know, choose your own adventure.
Right. I think they may really explore the format in a way.
Yeah.
And that will be really interesting. I mean, I think that with this one, like you said, it doesn't really break out of the kind of standard cable series format the way that it could and the way that Bo Willimon in some interviews has sort of implied that it did. Oh, it's a 13-hour movie, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's very distinct episodes.
Yeah.
And they do vary pretty widely in length. but you definitely feel the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
There are even sort of breaks within where you could imagine a commercial going.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it's more conventional than it needed to be.
And I think in some countries it will air that way. I mean, where Netflix operates, I think it will be on Netflix. But I can see it, you know, being dubbed into Danish and, you know, airing on Danish television, for example. So for those markets, it will need to be a more standard show. You know, after this next few months, it'll be just another show available on Netflix.
Right. And in reading a bunch of those articles about what Netflix was doing, it occurred to me that, I'm convinced that the reason they put it all out at once is because they wanted people to accept the fact that this is how TV is going to work.
Yeah.
You know, they want people to start getting used to the idea that you don't have to plan your schedule around it.
Right.
It's not on cable. It's not on a certain day.
Yeah.
Even though people do that with DVRs, I think they really want it. They're really investing in that shift
yes.
in people's habits
yes.
and ways of thinking about television.
Yeah. I've noticed, you know, whenever I've done a piece about Hulu, there are always posts in the comments that I'm 99% convinced are written by Netflix employees that say, why would I wait a week to watch a show? I like to watch all of the episodes at once. And, you know, I know that that is a lot of people's preference, but it is just one way to experience television. It's not the future. It's a possibility. And
right.
it wasn't a possibility just a few years ago, but it's just one option.
Yeah. That's exactly how I feel, too. Well, I'm glad that you, like me, burned through this TV show so we could discuss it soon rather than waiting until
and
later.
And just think our spoiler special lasts only about 2 episodes of House of Cards because we have gone on rather a long time.
Yeah. Well, and I hope that we can do another one when Arrested Development comes up.
Maybe with someone else. I'm not much of a Arrested Development person.
Well, thanks for joining me, June. This was a Slate Spoiler Special. For June Thomas, I'm David Haglund. Thanks for listening.
Very nice.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.